So now for talk this evening. Somebody did from overseas sent an email asking for a particular topic this evening. So we'll find out what that topic is when I really get into it. But we'll start off by just letting people know that just even almost like carry on a little discussion I had with a few people before the meditation began. And that was that many of the monks, including myself, have had our COVID-19 shots. And I often wondered just, you know, why are we taking those shots? And of course, the particular brand which we have available right now is called, you know, the AstraZeneca. And I remember just many years ago reading a Buddhist book about, like, everyone should put some Zen in their life. So that encouraged me that AstraZeneca was probably good for Buddhist monks. It's got some Zen in it. But I also read that there is a side effect to that particular vaccine. I don't even read all the side effects. The side effect is longevity. Long life. So why not? But also allows you to go on airplanes and travel around whenever things get better in this world. But nevertheless, that sometimes when people do discuss these things, that sometimes you just wonder just where people get information from. So, where do I get my information from? Very rarely do I get it from articles and things. A lot of time you get it from your own insights, you know, knowing just how your body works and what your body needs. And I do often doubt science. And that was an amazing thing of being trained as a scientist, a theoretical physicist at Cambridge University in UK. Just, you know, it's really up there. But seeing some of the weaknesses in science, and also the desire for people who are in those fields to always be afraid that they may be wrong. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with being wrong. In other words, we all do make mistakes from time to time. But when you do make a mistake, it's wonderful to admit it. And when you admit it, then you can be honest with yourself and learn from it. It's one of the things which I remember the Buddha telling his son. You know, before the Buddha became a monk and became enlightened, he did have a child. And eventually his child became a monk too. And when the child became a monk, of course the Buddha gave him a little bit of special attention and always taught him the importance of honesty. It wasn't just, you know, honesty when people ask you a question, but it's also honesty to yourself as well, how you feel, whether you make a decision or maybe it's a wrong decision or not. But of course, with making decisions and calling it wrong and judging it, can you really honestly do that? Here's a nice story I haven't told for a long time. As you all know, the talks which I give on a Friday evening, they just make them up as I go along. If a story comes up, yeah, you're going to get it. And that's the story, like right or wrong. And the story, it's a beautiful story, I enjoy telling it, even though, and I mention this, I have heard it most times of all, more times than you have. Every time I say it, I remember it. And that's a wonderful story of the good, bad, who knows story. You remember that story? Some do, but anyway. This particular story, it was based in those olden days when, using a simile which people could relate to, there was a king And the king liked to go hunting in the forest. And the king always had the fastest, the best horse. And so the king was chasing an animal in the forest. And because he had the best horse, the fastest horse, he was racing ahead of all of his, associates. That he was racing very hard and trying to catch something, and he wasn't mindful enough, so he scratched his finger on a tree branch, and it hurt. It had some blood coming out of it. So on that hunt, there was a doctor there. The doctor to look after the king, obviously, not the animals, poor animals. But anyway, he asks the king. So the king asks the doctor, "How's my finger?" And says, "Oh, it's just a scratch, you'll be okay." Put a band-aid on, and off they went hunting again. And by the time the king got back to the palace, that finger was red and inflamed. It was only a little scratch, but it must have been some poison ivy or something, I don't know, in the forest. So the doctor had a look at it and said, I'd better clean it up. So he washed it, took the band-aid off, washed it, put some ointment on, put a bandage on it. And then he asked the doctor, "Is it going to be okay now?" How can you predict the future? We never really know. So all the doctor said was, good, bad, who knows? Have you been to doctors and they've given you that advice? You got stage 4 cancer, is it going to be survivable? I don't know. If they were honest, they would say that. Because no one really knows whether it's going to get better or get worse. And I love telling this little side story, that when I used to go traveling much more, and was over in Malaysia, and going from, I think it was Taipei, over to Penang. And in the car, there was a lot of us in the car, a male driver, and I was in the passenger seat, and there was this about 50, 60-year-old woman in the back. And she was a very wonderful Buddhist, but she was also an oncologist. And she said she was about to retire. We just had a conversation about all sorts of things, but this conversation I really remembered. And she told me, in all honesty, in front of a monk, she was a Buddhist, she wouldn't exaggerate or lie in front of me. And she said, "I'm going to retire soon, another few months. But," she said, "these days when my patients come into the consulting room, because they have cancer, and these days," she said, "I can tell with about 90% accuracy who's going to survive and who's going to die. Not on what stage cancer they have, not whether it's aggressive or benign or whatever else." She said, "The main thing I judge it on, not the biopsies or the CT scans or anything else, what I judge it on," she said, "was on people's attitudes, their character." He said, "That to me is a far more accurate prediction of who will survive and who wouldn't." And when she said that, in all honesty, and I thought, wow, this is a person who's at the forefront of being a doctor on oncology, facing some of these problems. And my goodness, I think that she's right there. Because all the things which I saw in my life, the people who are sick, who survives, who doesn't survive? And quite often it is your attitude, the kindness, the gentleness, the ability not to worry. That's one of the reasons why one of my favorite monks, which I got to know only just in passing in Thailand, this beautiful monk called Ajahn Tait. And because when I first became a monk, this man, Ajahn Tait, monk, he was dying of cancer. And he was in the best hospital in Bangkok at the time, the hospital which many doctors had trained over in the United States and UK and other places. So I had the very best care, and it was all paid for by the King of Thailand. Because now you respected this monk, being a great teacher, meditator, very virtuous, simple living monk. And after this monk got the diagnosis, there was nothing more the doctors can do. It's terminal, he's going to die. You know what this monk did? Yeah, I'm not going to die. It's a waste of time dying in Bangkok. I want to die in my monasteries. It was a beautiful monastery. I've been there many times, on the banks of the Mekong River, in the west part of northeast Thailand. And so that's where he went back to die. It took about 20 years to die. And he was one of my favorite monks. And this particular, there's quite a few stories. That once, you know, it's on the banks of the Mekong, you just look out, there's Laos on the other side of the river. And this was a time just during the, I think just after the Vietnam War had finished, and Laos was taken over by the communists. And one evening they were doing their evening chanting, just now on the banks of the Mekong River. And then a machine gun opened up on them. From the other side of the river. And Ajahn Tae said, all the monks go down on the floor. So they all crouched on the floor, because there's real bullets. Bang, 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 bang. And they were wondering, what have we done to offend, the troops on the other side of the river? We're just, peacefully chanting. Were we chanting out of key, or I don't know what happened? But then one of the bullets hit the generator. That's the only way they can get enough lights to have the meeting. And as soon as the generator stopped working, the voices came from the other side of the river, and don't turn on that noisy generator ever again. That's all the people didn't like, noisy generators. It was pretty dangerous shooting at them. But anyway, he's always a very good monk, he wasn't scared, he just, okay, down on the floor. But anyway, this is a particular monk when I went to go and see him. Now, because I had questions on my meditation and on other stuff. Who can you go and ask? So anyway, I went over there to see him. And even, I was only about 6 or 7 years as a monk at the time. And even I had to wait in queue. And that's not a queue, make an appointment. I had to wait for a couple of days before my appointment came up. He was a very, very well-known, famous monk. And I waited all that time. When my time came to have the appointment, I went into the room. And first of all, just even though he's quite a well-known, famous monk, he was so small and simple. And that inspired me to begin with. Just demeanor with someone who you could just walk in the streets and you wouldn't even know that this was a famous monk. And then all the questions which I had, which I'd waited for days to ask, which I'd travel such a distance to get to that monastery to ask. All these really, 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 really important questions, they vanished. That was a wonderful experience, because I had no questions in my head, which was so peaceful, so happy, and it was embarrassing. That's what I learned from him. The answer to all questions is silence and peace and kindness. Because that monk was just zapping with loving kindness, compassion. And that's what you felt. Not intellectual answers to questions, but the incredible peace there. And I did have a thought came up in my mind. And the thought which came up in my mind, this is honest, I will always remember this, was they're going to have to drag me, they're going to have to tie me up with ropes and drag me away from here with a water buffalo. I'm not moving. Have you ever been in those situations where you're so peaceful, so happy, you don't want to go anywhere in the whole world and people have to drag me away? I just want to stay here forever. It wasn't being in love with a being, being in love with peace. with kindness. And there, there was just so much satisfaction and contentment. It was gorgeous. But anyway, that was a monk who should have died years ago. Eventually he did die, but when you actually saw just how the mind and the body interact, that's really incredible. And that's one part of medicine which is not investigated enough. In fact, that science, and it just disappoints me, doesn't even admit the existence of a mind outside of the brain. Too many times, I'm going all off on all tangents. I'll go back to the king story in a moment. But always remember just these articles which people... If it's an article which challenges things, that's what I really like. But this was a article, I think I've still got a copy somewhere, of... I think it was some science magazine, Nature magazine, or I don't know, Scientific American or something. But anyway, Professor John Lorber, L-O-R for Robert, B-E-R, Lorber. He was a professor in Sheffield University in UK, and he was doing research into something which no one would ever think is really worthwhile, is the shape of human skulls. If you ever look at the skulls on people now, if you take off, you know, the hair away, it's very easy to see my skull because it's not hidden by hair or hats or things. Some people have very weird shape skulls. Most people's skulls are, you know, pretty normal. But this was the expert, the world expert on the shape of human skulls. And he wanted to find out if you have an abnormal shaped skull, whether that would affect, you know, your other parts of your life. Now, you know, your intelligence, your physical abilities, you know, just your social ease with other people. But anyway, that was his field of research. He got a grant for it. In those days, it's much easier to get grants, apparently, for weird research. But he found this one student in his college who was a graduate student in mathematics, a really smart kid. So he's doing a PhD in, or master's, I think, I'm not quite sure, one of the two. He already got his bachelor's degree in maths at Sheffield University in UK. And his skull was slightly deformed. No one else would notice it, but this professor noticed it. And he asked this student, "Can you come on my research program?" And you don't get much out of this, maybe a little few pounds to get a few extra beers in the pub, that's about all. But, you know, the people were quite helpful. So he said, "Yeah, sure, no trouble." So one of the things they did was to give him a CT scan of inside his malformed skull. And that was when, as they say, the SHIT hit the fan. They've got beautiful words, which, you know, why can't I say them? It's just, you know, because people tell me off. It's shit hit the fan. Because there was no brain inside his skull. There wasn't a brain there. He took it again. Nothing wrong with the machine. This was a graduate student in mathematics. He had a girlfriend, a very socially... at ease, human being, having a wonderful life, but he didn't have a brain. One 1% cortex, I think he said, 99% of stuff which is usually found in the human brain was missing. And they can understand why that created such a problem. He was intelligent, he was socially normal. In fact, if anything, he was better than normal. He didn't have many of the problems, depressions and other things, which a lot of people have in university in those days, and these days as well. How could that be? And I remember just, because I tell the same stories in many, many places, and you throw those stories around and you get some extra information about them. And this was one doctor, who was a Buddhist, who was on one of my retreats in Sydney many years ago. I was talking about that to him. And he said, "Wow, you know that." I said, "Yeah, I saw it in a magazine." He said, "He's seen copies of those CT scans." He said, "They are real. That actually happened. They did it two or three times because they thought the machine must be wrong." And he said, "What happened next?" I asked. He said, "And those CT scans, that report, was put in the filing cabinet at the back somewhere and called an anomaly. In other words, give it a name, you can forget about it. The boy with no brain. How can that happen?" The only explanation, there was not enough sort of grey matter there to get first class honours degree in mathematics from Sheffield University, to be socially adept and healthy in every other way. How was his body working? It was just too difficult. That's why it was an anomaly and they put it away. It's the mind is taking over. It's two different things, the body and the mind, the brain and the mind. It's how the mind affects the body is perhaps the most important. But of course, that's been part of Buddhism since the very beginning. It's why there can be a thing like rebirth, reincarnation. Your body dies, your brain dies, but your mind can carry on. Why it is that people, when they're dying, they may go into a coma. You may not be able to, they may have dementia. And the last few minutes of their life, they open their eyes and they can remember everybody. I remember just giving a talk about that in Singapore Hospital. And I just asked, because in front of doctors and nurses, how many of you have had experiences like that? It's a common these days, which is why they call it terminal lucidity. You can look it up on the internet, terminal lucidity. It's when a person is about to die and they get clear. They can remember everybody. And I've mentioned this many times, and one of those times, just after the talk, one of the people came up to ask the questions, and he said, "I'm a doctor, that happened to me a few days ago." "What happened?" He said he was, it's just a young doctor. One of his patients was, you know, started the dying process. Death is a process and has certain sort of signals, you know, the person is going. So he rushed to his patient's bedside. He'd been in a coma for quite a few days. And he knew exactly what the person wanted. He had the address book of the closest relations in the drawer. So he got out the address book because, you know, there's no way they could actually keep the patient alive. And started ringing the closest relations. And he said he got to the daughter, Julie or something. He was ringing Julie up and said, "You better get to the hospital quickly, your father's dying." And that was the point when the father opened his eyes and said, "Please tell Julie how much I love her." And then he closed his eyes and died just then. I hope I got the story pretty exact, but I think that's true. How the heck could that happen? The guy had been in a coma for days. And now he could actually speak. But only those last few moments. It's the brain taking over. Or what about when a person is just born? When the brain takes over. You know, I was conditioned, brainwashed as a scientist. And as a scientist, it's those anomalies, those special cases, that's where you get the breakthroughs, you know, which, you know, can change your whole picture of life and the universe and everything. And you can't just shove these anomalies in a back of a filing cabinet and just call it just, "Oh, well, you know, we can't think about this." It's those things which really challenge you, which you have to face and rework your assumptions of life. And those are the things of babies talking. And we're having Vaisak soon, next week, the birth of the Buddha. According to the story, when the Buddha was born, he walked seven steps and said, no, this is my last life. I thought, that's just myth. You know, when you have all these birth stories of religious leaders that are always, you know, just made to be magical, stars appearing in the sky, no father, you know, the virgin birth. Someone talking when they were born. And of course, there's been examples even here in Perth. Because years and years and years ago, this is when Ajahn Chakra was here as well. Because this couple came, and it was here. In those days, I would come up here as well, or they came to Bodhinyana, but I remember hearing it. That was this couple. And they weren't Buddhists. I don't know what religion they were, but you know, they were Caucasian. They said, well, you know, you guys are supposed to know about reincarnation, rebirth. We thought you might give us a decent answer to what actually happened. So what happened? They had two sons. The eldest son, 2 or 3 years of age, younger son just born a few days ago. They come back home and they told their oldest son, only 2 or 3 years of age, time to go to bed. Go and say goodnight to your baby brother, Paul, or something. So the eldest son, Peter, he went over to the little cot, you may call, where his new baby brother was lying, and leant over. And it was only 2 or 3 years of age. I didn't really know what it could do, what it couldn't do. So 2 or 3 years of age, he went over and said, good night, Paul. And that's when Peter said, so that's when Paul said, good night, Peter. He was only about 4 or 5 days old. That's great, isn't it? That's marvelous. This is not Disney. This is not special effects. This is before they had any special effects and computers. And the couple, when they heard this, they were so confounded that they stopped what they were doing and just stared, you know, open mouthed. What they just witnessed? Their baby talking. And without any cue or any instructions from their parents, the elder son said again, good night, Paul. And this time they were both listening intently. He said, good night, Peter. The baby spoke again. And interesting, I would still remember hearing them. They said it was said in a adult voice, not a baby voice, which was interesting. And when I say stories like that, people actually come afterwards and tell me more stories. Yeah, it's great. And one of those other stories was a Malaysian couple here. They had their kid, and their kid spoke. And they said, when I heard the story from you, we thought, you know, this is really weird. But same happened to our kid. He said, we never told anybody. And the reason was we thought people, you know, put us in Greylands Hospital for the insane or something. We said it happened, it worked. So this is the mind working. It's one of the reasons why, as a Buddhist monk, as a scientist, you look at this mind and just how powerful it is. And anyway, so back to the king. Racing through the jungle. Oh no, that's right. He got his finger cut and then sort of, you know, put a band-aid on. Is it going to be all right? Oh, good, bad, who knows? And then goes back and gets infected, and so he puts another bandage on. Is it going to be okay? Good, bad, who knows? And often say, if your doctor said that, you know, took the biopsies, you know, looked at your health, and is it going to be okay? Good, bad, who knows? All the doctors here, have you ever said that to your patients that come after, you know, for after a consultation? Am I going to live? Good, bad, who knows? That's if honesty. So anyway, so the king goes back, and then after a couple of days, his finger's really infected. It's gone black, gangrene or something. So the doctor says, oh my goodness, that really is terrible. So only one thing to do, to amputate your finger. Or it may be one thing to amputate an ordinary patient's finger. But if it's a king, you're in big trouble. So the king was not impressed at all. Or as I usually say, he was not amused. Losing a finger. And put that doctor in jail, you stupid doctor. You don't know what you're doing. You know, my fingers is, you know, is really not there anymore. So, you know, so we put the king in jail. And what do you think about being in jail, doctor? And the doctor said, being in jail, your majesty, good, bad, who knows? If you were put in jail, would you actually be equanimous like that and say, it doesn't matter, maybe good, bad, who knows? So the king thought it was a really stupid man, this doctor. I don't know why he ever employed him as a doctor. So a couple of weeks later, when the finger was healed up enough, the king was in the jungle again, in the forest, just, you know, on his horse, hunting again. And this time he saw another animal and went really fast after this animal, racing very, 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 very fast. And he got separated from everybody now. And when he was separated from everybody, he got lost. He didn't have GPS on his horse. Oh, come on, you don't mind me making up parts of the story. So, got totally lost. And he was wandering around in the deepest parts of the forest he'd never been to before. And that's when he ran into the indigenous people in the depth of the forest. And they captured him. And the reason why they captured him, because it's one of the holiest days of their year, a full moon day. And on that full moon day, this particular indigenous tribe, they usually did sacrifices, usually animal sacrifices. But now they said, wow, we can do even better than an animal sacrifice. We've got a human being, a king. Our gods will really appreciate when we sacrifice such a wonderful being. So we'll have really good harvest, good fruit on our trees, and good luck for the next year. So they really got excited. So they tied the king to a tree so he couldn't move. And then they got their priest out and they started doing their ritual. They're chanting, boom, 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 boom. And usually at that part, the crescendo, that's when you usually get out the knife to cut the sacrificial animal's throat. They were just about to get the knife and cut the throat, but one of the priests said, stop! That human being, he's only got 9 fingers. The human being is not perfect. We cannot give an imperfect gift to our gods. They will think we don't respect them. Just like when you don't give perfect dana to one of the monks or nuns. No, we still respect you. But not gods. So then we can't sacrifice him. He's imperfect. Only got 9 fingers. So, oh my goodness. What can we do with him then? The only thing you can do is just untie him and let him go. But they weren't just, they didn't hate the man. It was just they wanted a sacrifice, that's all. And so they were kind enough to say, well, we can take you back. So they took him back through the forest through the shortcut and then just got close enough to the palace. You can see the palace over there and they let him go. And he soon walked back to the palace and people just so relieved that the king had returned. But the first thing, the king did? Went to the dungeons to apologize to the doctor. He said, I put you into jail because I thought you were stupid. I thought that losing a finger had to be bad. But actually, he told the whole story to the doctor. Losing a finger actually saved my life. And I've got you to thank for saving my life. Losing a finger actually was a wonderful thing. How could you ever know that losing a finger was so good? But, he said to the doctor, it was a bad thing that I put you in jail for that. So I apologize unreservedly. I'll let you out of jail. And what can I do for you to make up for that? At which point the doctor said, what are you talking about? is a bad thing putting me in jail. Didn't I tell you, being in jail, good, bad, who knows? As it turned out, it was a good thing I was in jail. If you hadn't put me in jail, I would have been on the hunt with you. I would have been caught, and I've got 10 fingers. You saved my life. So little by little, sometimes we can't judge even, you know, what's good, what's bad, who knows. I don't know who you got married to. Is that good? Bad? Who knows? I just mentioned this to the monks the other day. I don't know how it came up. Yes, one of the reasons I became a monk was about when I was about 19 or 20, I fell in love. 6 months with my girlfriend. Oh, what a wonderful time we had. And then, she dumped me. Good, bad, who knows? It was great, it was good. Thank you so much for dumping me. Otherwise, I would never become a monk. Little stories like that. That's why you don't get upset and angry. What happens to you in life? At the time, you may feel, ooh, this is terrible. Ooh, I've got cancer. Ooh, I've got COVID. Ooh, I've got this. Ooh, I've got that. Ooh, I haven't got anything at all. That's more like my life. Because I haven't got very much. I haven't got any diseases. I haven't got any possessions. That's why for the first time in years, going to the doctor, you have to fill out the forms before they give you the COVID shot. Have you got this? No. Have you got that? No. Have you got something else? No. I didn't have anything. Got no credit card, got no money, got no house, got no wife, no kids. As a monk, I've got nothing, including diseases. Good, bad, who knows? It's pretty good. Enjoying myself. But anyway, where we're going with this talk. Oh, yeah. Going back to where was I? Oh, yeah, to finish that one. Oh, yeah. The subject which somebody asked me to talk about tonight. And it's a serious one because the person, they say, they heard one of the talks that I gave about autism and schizophrenia. And they have Asperger's, OCDC, which I got right this time, didn't I? It is OCDC. I usually say ACDC. Is that right, OCDC? Yeah, anyway, something like that. ADHD. Okay. Oh. That was not even close, was it? But number one, you know, that sometimes about mental... I'm not going to even use the word illness. It's just difference. Illness. I don't know how actually to say anything about what people regard as illness. It's difference. It's not being... you know, common, it's being unique. Not call it illness, because illness straight away stigmatizes these things. And that's something which you do not like doing. And number two is the judging idea of this. You mention a word like schizophrenia, you mention like autism, Asperger's, ACDC. It's a long way to the top. If you want a sausage roll or something, that's what the monks say. You can see just how names actually create these judgments with them. And that is one of the biggest problems. One nice thing which I remember when I was a school teacher, part of school psychology is why we judge our kids. You've all been a kid from time to time. Were you judged at school? A class, B class, C class, D class. Because this experiment was actually performed. And it must have been, it changed a lot of the way I thought about interaction with people and the way we judge people. They can be sick, they can have cancer, they can be have autism or whatever. Why do we judge so much? Because this particular story was the two classes of children. They're probably what was now known about year sevens or eights, nines or something. It wasn't an, well, every age is important, but it wasn't a really crucial time at school where you're going to be sent to university or kicked out of school or something. So they had permission to do this test with these two groups of kids. In this one year, they had two classes, about 30 kids in each class. And at the end of the year, they gave the exam, the end of year exam, in order to assign kids to the next year's class. But this year, they did the exam as normal, but only the principal and two psychologists were in on what was really happening. They're the only one who knew the results from the tests. And what they did, they graded everybody as usual, you know, who came top, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, as you usually do. But on this occasion, the child who came first was assigned to the class next year together with the children who came fourth and fifth, eighth and ninth, 12th and 13th, 16th and 17th, and so on. And the children who came second and third went in the same class as those who came sixth and seventh, 10th and 11th, 14th and 15th. In other words, they split the two groups up as evenly as possible based on the end of the year results. And then they chose teachers for the next year, equally able, classrooms, equally well appointed. They made everything as equal as possible, except for one thing. They called one class A and the other one class B. That's all. And there were a lot of effort to choose them equally from the results of the year before. And those only three people knew what was going on. The principal and the two psychologists. The teachers, even the deputy principal, didn't know what was happening. Imagine what it was like. You know, one kid was put in class B. No more privileges for you. If you don't do better at school, you know, you won't be able to go to the football matches, you won't be able to get any privileges, you won't be able to do this and do that. Study more, you're in class B, you can do better than that. Well, other kids hadn't done a bit of work all year. Wow, you got in class A? Well done, son. Wow, we never expected that of you. But what happened? They taught these kids for the next 12 months. And they gave them the end of the year exam again. And what happened? When I saw this, you wanted to laugh and cry at the same time, because these were real people and how it affected them. The children who were in class A did so, so, so much better in the end of year exams than those who went into class B. Simply because they were called class A kids. They expected more out of themselves. The teachers taught at a higher level. The parents encouraged them more. Those in class B became class B children. Only because of the name which had been given to them. Can you relate to that? Sure you can. So that's one of the reasons why. It wasn't something inherent in the human being. They weren't stupid kids. They weren't smart kids. They were called smart and they became smart. It's one of the reasons why. If you call a person, you got Asperger's. What are you doing to them? You're autistic. You've got ADHD. I got it right this time. You got cancer. You got stage 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever. How dangerous is that? To give a person a label and then they'll live up to it. Sometimes, desperately stupid idea. In my life, you see, every person's got any sickness. Any sort of, don't even call it a sort of a sickness. Anyone who's any different. Why can that not be that the person can live in this world and just be autistic, be schizophrenic, be ADHD? Can we make use of that? Instead of stigmatizing it and think this needs to be cured. I said, oh, you mentioned I had girlfriends when I was young, one at a time. I couldn't afford anything else, I was poor. But I knew some people who were gay, lesbian, transgender. I knew many people wanted to cure them. What on earth are you doing that for? Instead of curing, how about respecting? And then beautiful gay, lesbian, transgender, and the whole works of people, they can adorn our world and make our world a far better place. That's just with gender. What about with these other mental differences which people have? Wouldn't it be a wonderful time when people with the autism spectrum, including Asperger's, when they're respected, they find their place in this world instead of being pushed aside, stigmatized, feeling that they don't fit into this world, feeling there's something wrong with them, they want to be cured. What does that do? I was a Buddhist. To some people in my family, that was weird enough. They'd love to have cured me. You were different. Not better, not worse. But to find your place with respect. And of course, just I've got to go a bit faster. The last story which I usually tell every second week. The trees in the forest. Every tree in the forest is absolutely different. If you have some way of judging, only the straight trees are beautiful. No way. The crooked, bent, twisted, damaged trees in the forest where I live are always the more beautiful. I've said that once to clients of the mental health, people who actually suffered. And the biggest part of their suffering was they weren't respected. People feel they need to be cured. They were stigmatized. Imagine when people could be accepted. Just like I said to the people, the trees in the forest, doesn't matter how damaged, how different they are, they all belong. Even that, when people said that, just made them cry. Not to be cured, but you belong. Asperger's, you belong. Welcome. Number two is some of these crooked trees in the forest become the favorite ones. They're so gorgeous as well. I like to sit and just see them just become the best, most beautiful trees in the forest. You don't only belong, you are special. And if you could respect your differences rather than just try and just hide them away and make you just try and behave like someone you're not, what a beautiful person you would be and how much you could give. Asperger's, autism. It's a huge amount of wisdom, difference, which we can only respect, maybe. Our human race would be a much more advanced, much more beautiful. Cancer? Well, everyone who has had cancer, which I know, they always used to say it was the best thing which ever happened to them. When I first heard that, well, that really shocked me. Because this was coming from people who'd been there and gone through it. I've never been through cancer. But these are people I respected and known. So, wow, what do you mean? So yeah, it was sometimes painful, but they learned so much. The worst thing they can do was to worry and don't see the beautiful side of it. Good, bad, who knows? So that's the talk this evening. Thank you for listening. Sadhu. Very good. Okay, we've got questions here. Any questions from people here, first of all? Okay, people overseas. Here we go. Today the questions are from Norway, from Chile, the USA, Perth, and USA. First from Perth, why aren't you here? Okay. From Norway, how do you manage to not get carried away by your success and fame? Because your success is never total. Fame is a double-edged sword. If you have got any fame at all, you can't just hide away somewhere. Look, I'm well enough known in some countries. This is what happens to me by fame and success. In the airport, in Singapore Airport, Changi, when I used to go traveling, I was just changing flights, going from one terminal to, not another terminal, from one gate to another gate, just to have a connecting flight. And this bunch of really nice Indonesians saw me. They'd just come back from pilgrimage to the holy places and changing in Singapore to go back to Jakarta or somewhere. And as soon as they saw me, they said, "Oh, Jambam, can we take a photo?" Is there any Indonesians here? Please excuse me, but they are the number one photograph takers. So there's about 30 or 40 of them. They had to do individual ones first of all, and then the group ones, and then the twos, and the families, and oh, goodness gracious, it took forever. And I had to keep telling them, I've got a connecting flight. Oh, no, just one more. Just the last one. And there's about 30 last ones. And I'm not exaggerating. When I got to the gate, they were calling my name out. I just, came that close to missing the flight within seconds. Well, the other time, in Hong Kong, when Hong Kong gave a talk, and these people are nice, they listen to the talk and then they ask their questions, and then I said, "Look, I've been sitting here for about 3 hours. I need to go to the toilet." I said, "Okay, yeah, please go." And then halfway somebody stopped me, "Oh, Jen Brum." And it was a long way to the toilet. They stopped me so many times. And then finally, the relief. There's very few moments of ecstasy for a monk, in a physical sense. And then finally I got into the toilet. Oh. Now I could just have a nice, quiet number one. And what happened was a guy was, I was maybe traumatized, I can remember this so clearly. He was just finished washing his hands after being to the toilet. He turned around, "Oh, Ajahn Brahm, can I ask you about my meditation?" It was in the toilet. I couldn't escape, so yeah, there's. I'm not to get carried away, I almost get carried away and fainted. All the pressure in there. So, anyway, success and fame, it comes and goes. Willingly, I enter a heavily dependent relationship. I thought it said heavenly. a heavily dependent relationship. Should I forgive myself to begin with, find guidance as soon as I knew this was meant to end like this, and got into it anyway? Oh, it's a dependent relationship. Give as much as you can, but always remember you also have a relationship with yourself. So please love yourself as you would love everybody else in your life. No more, no less. It's good to care, but a lot of people, they care for others and they live out one person in this world, which is themselves. So if when you care for yourself as much as you do for others, no more, no less, then you understand what we're here for. And in Buddhism, they used to have this idea of like Hinayana and Mahayana. And Hinayana, you're just caring for your own enlightenment, not caring for others. Mahayana, you sacrifice your own enlightenment to help others. Both are stupid. None of that works. If you're just in it for your own enlightenment, you never get enlightened. That's selfishness. You just give to others. You get burnt out. So the solution is not Hinayana or Mahayana, you're all in it together. So it's all about us. Not about him, her, or even me, about us. So we don't sacrifice anything. We're in the same old boat and going off to Nibbana. This will be my first Vaisak as a Buddhist, Adam from the United States. There are no monks or temples around here. In the whole United States, or maybe where you are. Besides keeping the 8 precepts, are there other practices or traditions I should do? Thanks. No, just be kind. It's the best. It's beautiful compassion and kindness to all beings, including yourself. A bit of meditation is wonderful. That's the kindest you could be. They always used to say that the greatest good karma you can ever make is getting into some nice deep meditation. That's making good karma. And being really kind. Giving yourself a break. And getting out of the hair of all the other people you live with. Go on a retreat and they'll appreciate that very much. And from Perth, how do I deal with people who are really awful to me? I try my best and be nice and show kindness and compassion as per Buddhist teaching. Don't try and cure them. Accept them. They're being awful to you. How can they even be more awful to you? So come on, you can do better than that. But what you really do also is you find they're not always awful to you. Sometimes they're actually kind to you. They come and shock them. But remember that. And every time they're kind to you, then let them have it. Thank you so much. You're such a wonderful person to live with. Praise. And in let them know just how much you appreciate when they're kind to you. When they're awful to you, just ignore them. Don't give any response at all. That positive reinforcement works wonders. Just like that story. Here we go, another story. It was a story, it's only 4 minutes past nine. The night is still young, so a few more stories. That was when I went to the United States years ago, many times. But anyway, I heard this guy was making a fortune training dogs in New York to poo and pee in the right places. And it's just very, very simple Buddhist teachings. You take the dog, the young puppy or something, out into the street. And they'd have little places, they had little trees or parks or something where they can do their business. And they'd wait. This firm, they had these trained puppy teachers. And when the puppy actually did their poo or their pee in the right place, these teachers, they would start dancing and singing a happy song and going, woohoo, yay, great, wonderful. They'd really just go over the top in just joy and happiness and delight. Yay, well done, woo, great puppy. And the dogs, they were sensitive to this. So much so that the dogs soon learnt to poo and pee in the right place. So you can do that to your husband at home. Every time he puts the toilet bowl down in the right place, toilet, not bowl, the cover, don't just tell him and say, oh, well done. No, just dance around, yeah, you did it, wow, what a great husband I've got, whoopee, yeah. Go over the top. And you'll find you'll do more the things you like to do. You just shout him when he does it wrong, and you do it more wrong. But anyway, so the puppies were well trained. And I thought, what a wonderful idea that was. Just, you know, how that positive reinforcement worked. But then, even when I was there, I found out a couple of weeks later, the business was in big trouble. Because what had happened, these were little dogs who had lived in apartments. They didn't have a backyard like we have over here where they can do their business. So what would happen, the owner and the dog were in the apartment watching a football match or a basketball match. And then the owner was watching his favourite football team or baseball team or something, and the baseball guy, you know, hit a home run, and he'd go, yay, wonderful! And that's when the dog pooed on the couch. So be careful of that. Anyway, that was a very funny story. Anyway, it's true, apparently. Okay, and Hema in USA. I'm in a relationship that my mother does not support because my partner is Muslim. He's a good person, but not always honest. Should I continue staying with him? Thank you. That is most of you. You've got to be honest together as a Muslim. So there is this couple I knew in Singapore, because I've been there for a while. But they were, what was he? He was, yeah, I think one of them was a Muslim, one was a Buddhist. They were married happily together. And they had two children. One of the children became a Hindu. The other one became a Christian. And I was really hoping they'd get pregnant again and have another child who could become a Jew. Then they have the full set. It was great that they had this family of like four different people in the family, four different religions. It can be done. And if it really is a good Muslim and a good Buddhist, why not? So you can tell, the name is Hima, is that a Sri Lankan name? H-I-M-A? Female name? No, Chinese? No. If it was, the reason I say if it was Sri Lankan, because the Sri Lankan people respect me. So if I say Ajahn Brahm says it's okay, it might work. Just like this Sri Lankan mother wrote this email to me. It was only just a few months ago. She said, my son came out to me, came out that he's gay. What should I do? It's a Sri Lankan mum. And I said, don't you chant, may all beings be happy and well. Your son is a human being as well as your son. So wish him happiness and well-being. Keep supporting him. Keep loving him. There's nothing wrong with being gay. It's not against the precepts. Can you tell me which precepts it's against? None of them. So love him to bits, as we're supposed to. Because I said that, because you know, then they actually took it more seriously. So that's one of the, you say, how do you manage to not get carried away by your success and fame? I exploit it. If you can make use of it, then go for it. Okay, so any questions from the floor? No, from the chair? You got one, yeah? Oh, no, that's nothing about it. It's
falling on unfertile ground.
Oh, no, crikey, look. If all of your semen fertilised an egg, we'll be in big trouble.
Oh, very well said.
Very well said, he said. Yeah. In other words, But it's just like the rules for monks, you know, we're asexual, I suppose. But then if you want to be gay and have a sort of that life, then fine. But don't be a monk as well. Because a monk, monastic, means, you know, you're celibate. You get your sort of energy going into other places, you know, into the mind in meditation. So, but anyway, there's nothing wrong with being gay. And there's a few people who were gay and became monks. I'm sure there's, you know, a few nuns were lesbian, and but the, when actually, oh yeah, I know a couple. When you actually become monastic, then you give up that sexuality. You practice celibacy. You just dress all the same, daggy. Anyway, so that's fine. So we can actually pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha now, and then we can see what happens. Was it a good talk tonight? Was it bad? Very good. Okay.
Arahant Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghaṃ Namāmi. Oh, yeah.